Some say this is the blind and ruthless inevitability of progress. Matrices multiplying, transformers transforming, learning, evolving, accelerating. It promises miracles, whispers threats. Will the revolution be vibe-coded? Forget the hype. What's really happening under the hood? We're finding out. This is the acceleration. Welcome back to the acceleration, where we ride the leading edge of AI's impact on everything, from life-saving technologies to the art that moves our souls. I'm your host, Avi Burra, and for our fourth episode today, I'm thrilled to welcome a guest who knows both worlds intimately, an engineer building AI systems in health tech by day and experimenting in alternative and progressive rock music by night. For this conversation, he's joining us under the pseudonym Dr. Neural MD. Neural has spent years wrestling with complex data pipelines and regulatory demands to bring AI into healthcare workflows that improve the patient experience. Then he switches gears using those same algorithms to shape soundscapes, experiment with AI-generated music, and push the boundaries of creative collaboration. In the next hour, we'll unpack how AI transforms high-stakes environments like healthcare, explore its role in the studio, and dive into the philosophical, ethical, and economic questions that follow. With that said, welcome to the show, Dr. Neural MD.
Thank you, Avi. Nice to be here.
Excellent. So can you share how you first became interested in applying AI both in the health tech environment and in your music projects?
Yeah, let's talk about the health tech side of things first. So, you know, we'll go into this a little bit, but healthcare, there is an enormous amount of expenditure in healthcare in the US, United States, and I think that's an understatement. Somewhere around $5 trillion is where we're at in U.S. healthcare expenditure. So obviously, there's a lot of factors, and we'll talk about them. But some of the wastage in the system actually is a prime target for AI. And AI actually, I'm an optimist when I think about a lot of these things, and I think AI could actually bail us out from this, but we need to be ready to embrace it. And not fearmonger on it for the enormous amount of value it's going to unlock for the United States and humanity. And then on the music side of things, you know, I've always loved progressive rock for how complex it is, for how, you know, artists like Porcupine Tree can really paint a story of building up tension and resolution. And it's not quite that linear, right? It actually, to build up tension and to build up resolution, these are very subjective things. So there's an interesting question to be asked of, what are these patterns that humans are, you know, pattern matching when we understand this? Because, you know, you see this even with babies. They sort of recognize music at a very early age. I think at 2 months they recognize riffs, and by 9 months they can actually recognize entire songs, and they have favorite songs. So there is something kind of pretty fundamental to the way our brain is wired to pattern match music. So if we are able to pattern match music within our own neural net, which is our brain, I think it begs the question as to, you know, what are these patterns? And maybe by understanding these patterns, we can understand what makes us human in a way, because there is, in my opinion, few more things human than, say, you know, a beautiful Van Gogh painting. You know, I was in Arles, the birthplace of Van Gogh, in France, and, you know, it's the sort of ultimate human expression, right? And this is a guy who basically lived most of his life as a pseudonym in a weird way and died and never saw the acclaim of his work. But Van Gogh is the sort of ultimate human expression in that sense, right? It's very pure, right? It's not sort of polluted or corrupted by the sort of narcissism that comes with being recognized, because unfortunately we do have those narcissistic tendencies. So I think that's what makes the Van Gogh sort of protagonist story so interesting. And then on the flip side, you have, you know, musicians like Mahler, you know, great 20th century, fantastic 20th century classical composer and post-romantic composer, and wrote magnificent world-building symphonies. And again, symphonies are incredibly, incredibly complex. Like, this is, I mean, the definition of world-building in a way. And to me, it's just a fascinating question of what is it that makes me want to listen to, you know, a Mahler's 8th Symphony performed by 1,000 people, or Porcupine Trees in absentia. You know, again, a journey is the best way to describe it, that lasts 45 minutes to an hour and can take you somewhere, right? There's something going on there. I think we all feel it. Everybody feels it. Babies feel it, right? 9 months old feel it. Old people feel it, you know. But we still can't explain it, right? So I think by looking at AI and sort of generative music, I'm not suggesting we'll be able to explain it all, but we'll maybe scratch the surface of understanding a little bit more about ourselves as humans. So that's a slightly long-winded answer to both of your questions, Avi.
Yeah, Neuro, look, we can take this conversation in two completely different directions. Ideally, I'd like to talk about both things you mentioned, the healthcare waste and how AI tackles it, and then this, in my mind, a slightly more profound conversation about how humans perceive art. So maybe we'll start with that one. Do you think it's possible, given the current computational paradigm and also the trajectory in which it's going, that an AI model, whether it's transformer-based or whatever the next generation is, that it is able to infer those patterns that make humans appreciate art? And I think music is a really good example, right? And the baby example you used is actually really great, because this is a being who's not yet fully developed as a human being, but their brains are just learning how to function. And they, if they are able to possess this ability to appreciate music and potentially even recognize melodies, meaning the repetitive patterns of notes, if you will, there is something there. So do you think where AI is today and where you think it's heading, AI will be able to infer and understand those patterns and recreate music and maybe art more broadly?
So let's talk about those two are separate questions, where AI is today, and maybe we could talk about where AI is tomorrow. The short answer, I think, to the question is AI today is very good at, it's the ultimate sort of Turing test exam hacker, right? AI today will pass any Turing test and will convince you of itself. But the thing you have to realize with even the transformer-based architecture today is it's ultimately trained on data created by humans. And there is an open question of, you know, exploration versus exploitation in this paradigm, whether AI could truly break new ground in art. And what does breaking new ground in art even really mean? If it's all just, you know, if it's all just something perceived. I think that's a bit of an open question. But my gut on this is that what you'll probably get from AI today is more somewhat of a tawdry imitation of what great artists actually produce. And this is the one frontier where it'll look very convincing, right? Because there is no litmus test of what a good song is. It is whatever a user thinks it is, whatever a listener thinks it is. And my gut tells me that you will see some AI hits, right? So let's make some concrete predictions just to ground this discussion. I think there will be a Billboard's top 100 hit created entirely from AI. And whether that will even be known to the listeners is a very big question mark, because it's quite possible that artists just use these AI tools. And then it sort of becomes a pretty open question of how much of it was the artist's contribution versus the AI's contribution. Hey, what if I'm just using AI for mastering a song? Does that in some way influence the art? Mastering does influence the art, but you could argue that it's the composition. Okay, then let's take it one step further. What if the AI actually helps formulate the verse and the chorus and things like that? Is that the art? So you could see how this discussion gets pretty hairy pretty quickly. So I think concretely there will be a piece of music that's in the top 100. Now, do I think an AI-generated piece of music will stand the test of time the way, let's say, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band by the Beatles, Pet Sounds by Beach Boys, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, all of these kind of timeless classics will stand the test of time? I'm going to take a stance on that and say with the transformer-based architecture, the answer is my prediction is probably not. And actually, there's some pretty good talks. Let's talk about the sort of drawbacks of the transformer-based architecture as a quick kind of segue here. And really explore your listener, would really encourage your listeners to see some talks by Jan LeCun from Meta's AI. And I think he does talk about sort of the limitations of a transformer-based architecture, since it is trained ultimately on discrete tokens. But our world isn't discrete, right? Our world is continuous in a way. So now I think the problem statement I can buy, what he proposes, I don't fully understand, but if any of your listeners have an idea, please feel free to leave a comment. But I think the idea is using, you know, joint embedding predictive architectures to create a better abstraction. So now whether JEPA is the answer to this or if there's some other answer is unknown to me, but it does smell to me that, you know, we are going to hit some kind of a limit with transformer-based architectures. And transformer-based architectures creating truly compelling art the way I'm defining it, you know, art that stands generations, I think we're still a ways away.
You talked about the transformer-based architecture using discrete tokens, and it will always be a pale approximation of the real world, which is continuous. That said, in the limit, right, if the discretization gets granular enough, it is for all intents and purposes continuous. Is that analogy applicable in the context of AI tokens?
It is, but just to put some numbers around this and like fact check me on this, but we're still talking about tens of thousands of tokens at this point. So now if you made that number 1 million, is that approximation better? Perhaps.
Actually, Neural, could I just pause first? Yeah. For our less technical users, do you want to define what a token is in the context of AI? And maybe if it's different in the context of AI music versus AI literature, for instance, can you make that distinction?
Yeah, so in large language models, a token is sort of like a basic axiomatic unit of text that the model processes. You can think of it as a segment of text, which can be a whole word, a part of a word, or even a single character or a punctuation mark. So LLMs use tokens to break down input text into smaller, manageable segments, making it easier to analyze and generate text. So, you know, typically you have a process of tokenization. So this is a process where the LLM uses various tokenization methods such as word, character, or subword tokenization to kind of break things down. And then these tokens then form a vocabulary that the LLM uses. And essentially, these tokens then end up getting a numerical identifier. I mean, we're now getting into a pretty larger conversation here about the transformer architecture, but there is an embedding layer where these tokens form, you know, get a point in an embedding space. And then there's several other layers within this kind of neural net architecture that ultimately predicts the next, well, token. So that's really all it's doing, is it gets a set of tokens, and the output is actually a lot of tokens. And what you can roughly think of as a probability, but really is just a number between 0 and 1, that tells you the likelihood of the next token being the right one. So usually, if you're using the ChatGPT API, there is a temperature param. I'm getting a little technical here, but when you set temperature to 0, it's picking the most the most deterministically likely next word. You could set the token, you could set the temperature to a greater number, and it'll pick something from that output layer of the neural net that that, you know, that there's some randomization basically between the top n tokens. But ultimately, in a nutshell, that's what LLMs do. They operate on these axiomatic units, and they're predicting the next one.
Got it. And then how would that work in the context of music?
So I think it's perhaps we could take a step back and talk about what attention is. So let's take a real step back. So let's talk about Word2Vec. So Word2Vec was this pretty innovative neural net architecture, the SkipGram architecture, which basically what it did was it creates an embedding space. So it's a popular technique used in natural language processing that transforms words into dense vector representations known as word embeddings, which capture semantic relationships between words. These embeddings allow computers to understand the meaning and relationship between words on, you know, based on their context, making it easier to perform text analysis and sentiment analysis and things like that. So the way you can think about this is essentially the word king and queen are close together in this kind of embedding space. But sort of the big, you know, the sort of drawback of this is it lacks context on the sentence. So, you know, the sort of next kind of evolution of this architecture was BERT. So this is bidirectional encoder representations from transformers, which really is sort of the thing that underpins a lot of what we use in LLMs today. So this is a powerful machine learning framework for natural language processing, again, developed by Google. It's designed to help computers understand the meaning of text by considering the context of words within the sentence, both left on the right side. So BERT uses transformer architecture, which is a type of neural net which is pre-trained on a massive amount of text data. So you have this kind of bidirectional context, as I was alluding to. So basically, it you know, it's understanding the, you know, meaning, the semantic kind of relationship of a word by looking at words around it. So when you think about this, this is actually how humans think of things, right? So, oh, you look lovely today, or you look lovely today. You know, that one has a different meaning based on the tone. And certainly, you know, there's nuanced forms of sarcasm that, you know, can vary based on even the surrounding words. So humans are rarely looking at, you know, words in isolation. So essentially, BERT is built on this. And then sort of the next evolution is, again, I'm jumping through a lot of steps here, but eventually you end up with, you know, something like GPT 3.5, which takes this to the nth limit. So now attention is this idea that you are encoding the meaning based on a lot of words, right? Based on the surrounding, a lot of surrounding context. How much of surrounding context? Well, different LLMs have different context windows, and this sort of plays into that. So now that's really what attention is, right? It's taking a bunch of axiomatic entities, which we call tokens, and it's assigning a meaning based on where the context of the tokens around it. So what this kind of relationship when you think about it, can be applied to a lot of things. It can be applied to text, which is how we use it today, which is why when you ask an LLM a question, you know, about Shakespeare, it just seems to know. It seems to understand what you're asking, but really it's using this kind of attention mechanism to really fool you well on that front. So that's how you would use it in text. Now in music, going back to, like, let's say Mahler's Eighth Symphony. So Mahler's Eighth Symphony is a long, long, dense piece of music, needing 1,000 musicians to perform it. It has this kind of bombastic intro, right? And then the sort of music, you know, it meanders a lot. There's a lot of some kind of like tension building. A lot of what, you know, classical music folks would consider almost atonal and borderlines on atonal. But the point is, it does resolve back to kind of that and that intro. And when it does resolve back, it feels really majestic and magnificent. So there is something to it, right? It's not just a bunch of noise. Like, this is my point. It's not just, you know, what atonal white noise, although it may sound like it when you first listen to Mahler. Admittedly, that's how it sounds like when you first listen to it. But there is something to it, right? And that something, that it factor, that pattern, like all these sort of words that are floating around this idea of essentially something there in terms of, you know, a pattern of notes. It's very reasonable to kind of see how that could be encoded with an attention-based architecture. So that's, I guess, the best argument I can give for using music LLMs. And by the way, the proof is in the pudding. When you listen to some of these music LLMs, it's truly fantastic. It's as good as anything you would hear. It's radio ready. It's good to go on Spotify and good to fool many, many people, and hence my earlier prediction.
Yeah, and you know, we took a welcome digression, I would say, into this topic. But I think what we were talking about is the number of tokens you believed it would take for an AI to generate a true masterpiece, perhaps not a Billboard top 100, which is not necessarily a masterpiece, right? It would be the most popular song. But an actual masterpiece like Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, or like one of Mahler's works, or maybe even like one of the Beatles' works, like the next Sgt. Pepper's, for instance, something timeless and enduring. So do you think it's a factor of the size of the context window?
That's a good question. So GPT-4o has something like 128,000 tokens. It's not clear to me if this is a function of the number of tokens or if there's something else fundamentally we would need to kind of cross, sort of like what I was alluding to with the JEPA architecture. Do we need another representation? Kind of like, the best way to think about this is like a second order representation of this kind of attention matrix. Something a little bit more abstract that the AI model, quote unquote, understands. That is the part of me that's not super clear yet. So I'm definitely, this is area of conjecture, but my gut, and this is purely my gut, is it probably would need some kind of a third, you know, second, or maybe even a third or fourth order level of abstraction to even understand that. That's point number one. And then point number two, I think it also does have to, you know, when you think about, okay, let's talk about Mahler, right? So this is a guy who, he didn't just arrive on the Eighth Symphony, right? Yes, it took him 8 tries before that, but even before that, it took him digesting Beethoven and really working and sort of importantly taking real signals and course correcting. And in an AI, there's this hot topic of reinforcement learning, this idea that, you know, you can take in signals even after the model is trained. And, you know, you refer to this as like, you know, test time compute and things like that. Again, conjecture here, but is it going to take, but I'll throw this out as an open question, is it going to take a paradigm shift in terms of these neural net architectures and reinforcement learning itself? Because, you know, when you look at reinforcement learning today, a lot of it is not super scalable, right? So let's take a look at a very successful example. So when Google made AlphaGo, right? AlphaGo, basically by the DeepMind team, essentially it was able to win this game by self-play, right? So it didn't require labeled data from human beings. All it did was it kept playing itself till it got better, and then it was beating the grandmasters. And then the same thing happened with chess. My gut tells me that if we can sort of get to these models being able to self-play on real-world kind of inputs that do not have very formally or well-defined reward systems, that I think feels like an exponential barrier. So when you, again, looking back at the sort of chess example, it's, you know what a correct state is, right? That there's only one way a game is going to end. And you can actually define it. You can define sort of what a checkmate is and what the sort of terminal leaf state of this massive directed acyclic graph is. And that's how these algorithms are able to basically learn, right? They're not brute forcing this entire graph. They're actually learning patterns within this graph. And they're able to make moves. I think there's like the famous move 37 or something like that with the AlphaGo, where it did something that confounded everybody. But that move ended up being very, very important, you know, several moves later. So the sort of self-play idea works pretty well when you can define that reward system well. And by the way, like, this is also why, you know, these kind of reasoning models excel at coding, is because there is a way to kind of formulate what quote-unquote good is. So these things are, during test time compute, able to do that. So that's fact number one. But fact number two, during the reinforcement learning phase, it's actually easier to kind of give that, you know, that feedback back to the model to actually fine-tune itself. So now, why am I talking about reinforcement learning in the context of music? Like, again, just taking it back to Mahler. This is a guy who learned with a lot of trial and error. And with a lot of these musicians, that's what it was. I mean, even the Beatles, you know, yes, they were famous by 1964, but I think when you sort of read a lot of the literature, you know, especially around the 10,000 hours stuff, I mean, yeah, they had a lot of repetitions before they even got their, you know, first really juicy hits, right? They played all of these shows in these dingy dive bars in Hamburg. But that repetition was actually turned out to be pretty important, because it did sort of allow, you know, John and Paul to kind of make all these fine tunes, which they can't even articulate, right? And this is the crazy part, is Paul McCartney cannot articulate why his music is so timeless, but it just is. So it's all these things that, you know, he's internalized through, let's go ahead and overload the term reinforcement learning. But that's what I think is kind of, in my opinion, the sort of next area of development, which I think could unlock something far greater, because, you know, it's not a scalable model. Like, when a baby is born, you don't train them on the universe of all of the internet, do you? You don't. I mean, yes, there is some pre-training. They do come with some weights and biases within their brain, if you want to overload that term, though the brain doesn't exactly work with weights and biases per se. So I do think we're in the early days. I think we're very, like, we will look back and we will say we are very in the early days. Yep. But when you're in the early days of something so explosive, there can be a lot of quote unquote hype around it. So we just have to see where things go and grind it out, you know, like people like me, builders, if there's other builders listening to this, like, yeah, just keep grinding it out every single day.
You know, I want to go back to something you mentioned about chess and coding, which is, for all intents and purposes, the terminal states, all the possible terminal states, or rather, all the paths that lead to the terminal state can be reasoned through, right? But for code, you know what the end goal is. Typically, you're building an application that does X, and you know what that X is, right? For a given set of inputs, you want a certain specific output. And similarly for chess, the terminal state is known, is to win the game through checkmate. And you can work back from there through that graph, as you said. But those are all things you can reason through. And which is why you see AIs at this point better than humans at doing that for the most part. It is interesting to consider, though, in art, music, painting, movies, whatever it is, literature, the terminal state is not that well defined. In fact, it's incredibly nebulous. It's, you want to make something beautiful, but what is beautiful? There is no objective definition of beauty, right? You want to, if you're a musician, you want to make something, perhaps, if that's your goal, to make something that moves your audience through their emotions, which is, you know, emotions are essentially these abstract higher order senses on top of our five senses that we have. But what is that? How, I mean, there's no clear definition. It's unclear to me if you can reason through what gets you to that quote unquote terminal state to the extent that one even exists. So I wonder if applying AI's advancements in highly deterministic areas like chess or like programming to something completely non-deterministic like art even makes sense.
Yeah, you know, I think the music industry would like to think there is a formula. I'm pretty sure the big labels would love to think there is some kind of a formula.
But that's not art, though, right? That's some commercial junk that's being recycled. We're talking about actual creation of art.
Yeah, that's exactly right, right? And they try to apply these formulas. And if we did follow these kind of well-defined paths, and actually, just to take a step back, like, what they do actually does quote-unquote work in the sense that they're able to generate sales, right? They're able to kind of monopolize a lot of these kind of top 20 playlists or whatever it is on Spotify. And you have a whole generation of people where that's the only music they hear is music from these big labels. And my personal take on that is sad in a way, right? But it does work in the sense that they generate sales. They're still in business, the last I checked. But the thing that annoys these labels are the radio heads, are bands like Muse, MGMT, Porcupine Tree. These bands that do not stay within these guardrails and arguably push the boundaries further and are still remembered. And I think this actually highlights your point, Avi, which is, you know, forget about AI. I mean, we've been trying this, right? We've been trying this for a while, since the 70s, actually. You know, the music industry wasn't even really much of an industry until, I think, the 70s. And the 60s, they started catching wind, obviously, the Beatles, Beach Boys, and there were a bunch of... But it hadn't maybe become as well-oiled a machine as the 70s. And then, you know, there was this period, I think, where there was a pretty good harmony of creative expression and sort of the commercial enterprise. You know, you could think of some of the music in the early 90s and the alt-rock scene. I definitely look back at Soundgarden, and I think of Super Unknown as a pretty fantastic album that's pretty timeless. Nirvana, you know, again, these are all examples of folks who came out of the blue, and they could not be produced by the enterprise. So it really sort of took them discovering them and trying to bring them in. And in many cases, they, you know, these musicians rejected the enterprise. And so when I think of a lot of this kind of mass produced music today, it does sort of feed on a generation of folks that is whose dopamine, like let's just say it out loud, right? Whose dopamine reward pathways have been compromised to a small degree by you know, apps like TikTok, where you know the first thing you do when you wake up is you do 40 shots, right? You do 40 like whatever TikTok shots, and your dopamine receptors are entirely depleted before your day's even begun. That can really have a long-term impact on you as an individual. I only bring this up because in the context of music and in the context of mainstream music, I think the formulas can still work as if the definition of your work is making a quick buck. But if your definition of work is creating timeless art, which is my definition of work, right? When I think of art, I think of what is something that's going to stand the test of time. That's what I think of as good art. You know, you listen to Mozart today, it still sounds as fresh as it did in the 1700s. You know, when you listen to, you know, and the same thing with Brahms or Beethoven, you know, the greats, you know, or Bach. When you listen to Bach, I think Bach's a particularly interesting one because Bach wrote like all this counterpoint music, right? All these melodic lines that interweaved in and out of each other. Do I think he was sitting there like coding out math? I don't think so. I think it was actually just something very innate within, something that came from absolutely within him. And he just went to, you know, whatever instrument he had in front of him, and he couldn't help but create the art that he created. So this is a long-winded answer to say, by my definition of art working, I agree with you. And hence my prior answer on sort of, you know, based on the definition of success, and certainly on this definition of success, I don't see AI in its current form actually being able to reproduce it, because humans have been trying that.
Yeah. So are there any generative AI music projects that you've taken on?
Yeah. So, you know, I think I've always enjoyed programmatic music, despite all the skepticism I revealed. I think there's, as a musician, it's still very interesting to try to fool myself based on rule engine based music. Because with AI, it's a black box. You put something in, it comes out. It's hard to kind of reason, which to me defeats the purpose a little bit. I do want to actually inspect the thing that created the music. So I've experimented with Max MSP and other generative music platforms where you can program, music and get something that sounds remotely like music. It's a form of artistic expression. You know, I do think of coding as art in a way, and this makes actually that quite literal.
Yeah, that's great. You know, we spent a lot of time talking about art. I can go another hour talking about music and art and AI and philosophy, but we have limited time. You did mention in your very first answer about your motivation for getting into health tech and how AI can address the waste. So do you want to expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, so let's go back to sort of what is the core problem before we talk about solutions. So the core problem is this eye-popping number of healthcare expenditure, $4.9 trillion, which is an insane amount of money. It's I believe the GDP of Germany, it's greater than the GDP of India. So, you know, and again, this number, you know, adjusted for inflation going back to 1970 was less than half a trillion. So the question becomes, what is it that's actually like driving this 10x growth? So let's, you know, steel man the case and like cut out all the sort of obvious, the obvious sort of causes. So cause number one, the first obvious thing you may ask is, hey, are people just going and getting their checkups more and just utilizing the system more? Well, the answer to that is no. It's not. They are not. So over the past 10 years, you can see this. If anything, it's gone down a little bit. But for the sake of, you know, to be statistically sound, let's just go ahead and say it's been flat. Okay. Then is the quality of care going up significantly compared to our peer nations? So, you know, the argument for this is, yes, we do typically where it's sort of very early to kind of jump on, you know, clinical trials for, you know, whether it's, you know, different kinds of immunotherapy treatments or other kinds of, you know, cutting edge medical technology. Yes. Does that account for the 10x growth? Absolutely not. Has that actually improved healthcare outcomes? Well, that's also very arguable. You could look at, you know, life expectancy and certainly plenty of other stats compared to our peer nations, and you see that we're not actually that much better, right? We're not like the superhuman breed of cyborgs living until 150, right? It's quite the opposite. We have kind of an obesity epidemic in the United States. We don't do the basics right, right? So what is actually going on then? Why is this number so high? Because it seems like a pretty important problem to actually double click on. Just when you think about the broader context of, you know, the United States, you know, I think of like health and welfare of the individuals of a country as a pretty, I would say, important metric for what makes a healthy and a happy country. So it's a pretty, I would say, worthy problem to jump into. So when you start sort of peeling this onion back, peeling this onion a little bit, you see that around 30% of the expenditure comes from hospital care, right? So hospitals are these large entities, and they've been steady around 30%, but the, you know, the share of the pie has remained the same, but the overall pie has been increasing. You know, physician and clinical services, that's another 20%. Prescription drugs, of course, that's a huge industry, and, you know, since the pandemic, you know, has seen a kind of a resurgence, and that's, I think, around 10%, still a pretty large number. And yeah, this is data that I've gotten from Centers of Medicare and Medical Services, CMS, National Healthcare Expenditure Data, so I can link all the things in the footnotes of this podcast. So what is going on? So one of the factors I think we can observe is that, number one, these hospitals have been acquiring a lot of these, you know, sort of outpatient facilities and, you know, inpatient outpatient facilities, physicians and, you know, clinics. And generally, they've been employing a lot more providers in the healthcare market, right? So when a hospital can do that, then what they can also then do is actually improve their standing in the sort of negotiation bargain agreements that they have with payers. So, you know, if this is just a simple sort of microcosm of free market economics, if they were, you know, if there's a lot of competition, then the negotiation power decreases. But if it sort of starts accumulating, then it increases. So they have been in the, if you look at, and this is, by the way, all data from the, you know, price transparency data, you can actually clearly see an uptick and an increase in the cost per services. And that is the key reason, like going back to the top of this segment, the key reason why cost in healthcare has been going up is because the cost for the same services has been going up at that rate. That is the reason, right? And Unfortunately, in my opinion, that's the worst reason something should go up. All of the other things.
Go ahead. Neural, let me pause you. So when you say cost per services, is that does that factor in things like administrative waste, the different touch points that each service has, the claim submissions, and what have you?
Yes, that includes everything. So first of all, you know, when let's say you're a patient and you go to a doctor, first of all, you're probably going with an insurance, right? So you're chances are you have an employer-based insurance, right? That's 53% of the population. And then there's, you know, when you look at the pie chart, there's Medicare and, you know, federal and state insurances as well. That takes up a big part of it. So what happens? So you go, you have a deductible, you have a copay. So great. So you take care of all that. You get the services you asked for. That then goes to a clearinghouse, right? So that's not going to the insurer. The provider is submitting all of this data to a clearinghouse. The clearinghouses typically have APIs that can reject information. They have validation, input validation, which is actually an important part of this, right? Because it would be completely unscalable for providers to actually have direct connections with all of the payers. So it makes sense.
Yeah, it's like a post office, right? Like you, when people send mail, you don't want every person to go to the other person's house to deliver the mail. You need a post office, right? So that the post office becomes a receiver from the perspective of the sender and the sender from the perspective of the receiver, right? So that's sort of a post office is the canonical clearinghouse, if you will.
Yeah, I think that's a great example of clearinghouse. Yeah. So, yeah, post office does that. And then in the United States, you know, you have Availity and a bunch of these other clearinghouses that do that. So they take these claims and then they create X12 or I forget what other format, what other kind of format they create. And then this format then goes to an insurance company. And this is where sort of a lot of the magic of insurance companies kick in, right? So these are, again, large corporations that have pre-negotiated a lot of these deals with hospitals. So they have to look at that data. They have to look at their own financials, their own capex, their own kind of, you know, what it takes to keep them afloat. Like these are large corporations with large amounts of employees that need to get paid out. Leadership, which requires, you know, a large payouts and so on. I realize that's a sensitive topic, but it's just a canonical fact that, you know, these are large entities. And they need to stay afloat. So they're working and, you know, the financial incentives laid out by their investors and shareholders. And therefore, what you end up with is a system where a lot of these claims get denied. They have to get denied, right? It's not, again, it's not a reflection on sort of this evil person. I don't want to paint it that way. It's certainly not that simplistic, but they do have to stay afloat, which basically means they can't reimburse everybody.
Well, and in the US, there is this medical loss ratio of 85% by statute, right? Which unfortunately, as with many regulations, creates the perverse incentive that the insurer, so 85% medical loss ratio means an insurer, in theory, right, should be paying out 85% of all their claims, and if they only pay 80%, that 5% of the premiums have to go back to the patients, right? So, unfortunately, the perverse incentive there is, well, that means we get to deny 15% of the claims.
Yeah, and so again, none of this works for the patient, right? And when you look at the other factor here, it's sort of this population pyramid in the United States. You have an aging population. Now it's not as bad as some of the nations, but it's still pretty bad. It's not, you know, we're not at the level of China yet, but it is pretty bad. We have an aging population. They need healthcare. That comes from the state and federal level. And when hospitals cannot collect all their receivables from those patients, Well, then guess who, where the buck falls? It falls on the sort of younger, more commercially insured population. So that's another factor. So it's certainly a very, very multifaceted and nuanced situation.
Yeah. So how does AI fix this, though? Like, I guess that's what we're trying to get to here.
Yeah. So when you actually think about it, I think you hit upon this. There is a lot of waste. So let's start from the very beginning of the journey. So a patient needs care based on some conditions that they specify. So, you know, finding the right care or access to healthcare, that's definitely an area AI can help with. And there are lots of companies doing that very well. Discovering the right kind of doctor. And then I think the other areas is all this kind of black box. But once, you know, the appointment has actually happened, all the sort of stuff we're talking about, claim adjudication is, I think, a prime area where AI could come in. You could have, a medical LLM, and there are a few of these medical LLMs. You could take GPT-4, for example, and you could fine-tune it on claims data. And you could have it basically adjudicate claims. And my conjecture, mm-hmm. and I haven't done this, is you probably get something pretty accurate.
So actually, just on that point, right? So you mentioned claims adjudication. This is this process that healthcare payers or healthcare insurance companies, they use to quote, you know, it's a set of rules, right, that they apply to a claim that's been submitted to them by a doctor, by a hospital, by a healthcare provider, in other words, to make sure that it conforms to medical necessity and all sorts of. And these are, you know, we're talking about tens of thousands of rules here, right? And these are systems, for the most part, that were built in the 1970s and 1980s on IBM mainframes using COBOL. So to your point, maybe you can have LLMs trained on historical claims data and infer the rules based on the patterns within, or an insurance company can be the one who puts their hand up and says, you know what, we want to be leaders in this space. We're going to feed our COBOL code into O3 or Gemini 2.5 Pro, whatever the latest model is, right? Let it run amok and then refactor that into something clean and modern. Is that something you've considered?
It's something somebody should consider, I would say. And again, when you have the ground truth, and the ground truth again is what? It's the claims data, whether it was accepted or denied. And the sort of final format, if you will, of the claims data. You could just create a model to see how accurate it is. This, you could look at the precision and recall in terms of whether it was able to kind of predict the final state. This is something I would encourage people to try. Like, obviously, claims data is not available, but there may be data sets with Medicare or certainly de-anonymized data sets as I'm talking about this, I would love to give that a shot at some point.
Yeah, these things cost money, though. I think there are data brokers in healthcare who guard this information. You can certainly get de-identified information. It's typically a B2B, right, a business-to-business sale. I'm not sure if the open source healthcare world is healthcare AI world is taking. That might be something you know something about. Are you seeing signs of that?
Not really. Open sourcing any kind of healthcare stuff in the United States is very challenging. There are many, as you pointed out, many, many incumbents. Like we just talked about payers, but even within sort of these practice management software space, you have Epic, you have Cerner, you have a whole bunch of these. It's very, very fragmented. And ultimately, a lot of these folks, they want to stay afloat. They want to stay alive. So I think you're actually right in your intuition. There's a lot of gatekeeping when it comes to getting this data. So I don't imagine it's that easy.
Mm-hmm. So to summarize on the healthcare, there's a lot of waste, as you pointed out, and there are many opportunities to automate and modernize using AI. And a lot of this is just manual mechanical stuff. So AI would be great for that. But on the point, so for the last topic here, Neural, talking about gatekeepers, right? And maybe we can broaden this out beyond just healthcare, but just AI applications anywhere. What are your views on where the trajectory of where proprietary models are headed, right? Obviously, Gemini and OpenAI have state-of-the-art models. The new O3 model is incredible. Gemini 2.5 Pro is incredible. But these are proprietary, and they're owned by corporations, and who knows what they're doing with their data. So do you see a need for a strong open-source contingent here, or are you comfortable with the trajectory things are at?
So I'll just say, like, if you look at the trajectory is open source. It doesn't look like that, but when you squint, you can see it. So just as a concrete example, like DeepSeek R1, like, blew the industry up, right? Like, this is an open source model. Now, whether they actually trained this thing on $5 million or what the exact amount was, you know, a lot of the discussion sort of dies in that nuance. But I think what is true is this was a very novel, basically O1-ish level quality reasoning model that was open sourced by a company whose main focus, by the way, was not even building LLMs. So to me, this tells me what this smells a lot like to me is that is where we're headed. I think Sam Altman himself conceded that they've been late to the open source game, and it's something I think they too as an organization want to get ahead of. You know, and there's different levels of open source. You obviously have Llama. You can get the weights anywhere. You can fine-tune it, and then a lot of companies have done that. So, I mean, it's very hard to, like, as a meta point, I'll just say, like, it's very hard to stop humanity, right, from being its peak self. It takes a lot. Like, there was a lot of pushback against even the electric lights, right? So it's worth thinking about these stories by the incumbents, the lamps. And for a while, it seemed like, wow, we're not going to have electric lights. But obviously, when you look back years later, it seems pretty obvious that, hey, the better solution won. And at the end of the day, it's very hard to stop human progress in its tracks. You can delay it. You can make it difficult. And making it less difficult is definitely a worthy problem worth fighting for. But I think that's where the arc is.
And in your mind, that uncrushable human spirit, if you will, is the open source movement?
I think so. I mean, when you look at, like, I mean, even like going back to Java, how many devices have Java again? I mean, I know this is a number that gets quoted, but it's like 4 billion or something, right? Like Java, like it cannot be overstated how much of a collaborative effort it was to build this. And it does take kind of groupthink to a large degree to actually cause, you know, innovation at such a scale, such a sort of decentralized architecture of open source ultimately makes it kind of pretty unstoppable. And now, if what we're saying is, hey, training LLMs is maybe you don't need, you know, all these billions of dollars, I think that lowers the barrier and makes it easier for new entrants.
So what does that do to the moat of an OpenAI? Like, what is their offering at that point? Because right now, in my view, O3 is the most, the full O3 model, right? Not the mini, is the most incredible model I've interacted with. Probably a glimpse into what AGI might look like. Actually, curious to hear your thoughts on that too. But before we go there, what do you think OpenAI's moat becomes? Because if the open source models are catching up, so if you have something that's as good as O3 or as good as Gemini 2.5 Pro, in 2 months, like, how do they differentiate themselves? How do they make money?
So, okay, I think those are two different questions. How do they differentiate themselves versus how do they make money? How do they differentiate themselves? I think they openly admit this at this point. They cannot simply differentiate themselves by making better models. And I think the word that gets thrown around a lot is user experiences. So they are sort of chipping away at that aspect of things, making this a lot more usable for everyday humans, doubling down on the sort of agentic frameworks, all of which are very, very good problems to double click into, right? Because you do want to sort of squeeze all the value out of this lemon that exists today, and I don't believe we have. And that's like making it easier to build on that kind of layer one, I think is a very worthy problem. Challenging. So that's the how do they differentiate themselves? How do they make money question? So I think they're actually looking financially healthy. Maybe this is a bit of a hot take, but with the sort of recent release of the daily active users, I want to make sure I'm getting this right. Active users, GPT, I'm just putting this. But they released something about how it's $1 billion or something. Abhi, you can just add a correction to this.
Yeah.
In the final thing. But it's something like 400 million users or 500 million in February 2025. So they are clearly on this chart. So what that tells me is this is the sort of the winner takes all power curve, the Apple effect, if you will, where, you know, even having something 1% better can get you, 90% of the market. And that seems to be playing out. So as long as they can maintain that 1% lead, which I think they can, because it's also a lot of the lead is quote unquote perception. Although with O3, as you were pointing out, it is a pretty fantastic model.
Yeah. So on that, I didn't mean to lead the witness here, but I when I said I've glimpsed what AGI might look like, but have you, in all the models you've used recently, have you had that feeling?
I've had that feeling, and it's not a feeling I had overnight, but I've been using O3 a lot. And for me, the asset test is I just keep going back to it. The quality of the answers it gives me, what it's able to one-shot, I code a lot, and it's able to one-shot things a lot better than even Claude 3.7 from my sort of anecdotal experience. It seems to be using tools a lot more, so much better tool usage, even during the kind of chain of thought phase. And, certainly when you look at all the benchmarks, the thing that sort of gets lost is like, yes, it's a little bit behind deep research on humanities last exam, but really speaking, it's not deep researching, right? It's not going and reading all these different links. It's getting pretty damn close without going and, spending an hour reading things. And I think I could definitely see this improving where you can give it more time or a budget to think. I think Sam Altman has hinted at this. So the short answer to your question is, I don't know about AGI, but it is a step up. Let's call it that. It's a step up improvement from, all these other general purpose models that I've been using until I started using this one.
Yeah. And Sam Altman has promised an O3 Pro, apparently in the next couple of weeks. It is interesting how that product is fragmented. Once upon a time, there was ChatGPT. Then it became 3.5. It was still one product. And then suddenly you had 4.0, you had 4, you had 4.0 Nano, 4.0 Mini, 0.1, 0.1 Mini, 0.1 Mini High, 0.1 Mini... You're right, and then 0.3, 0.4. It's amazing. And now I think he's finally realized, or they've at OpenAI have realized that it all needs to come into one. So I believe GPT-5 will be a singular model that can figure out the context and do what it needs to. We'll see about that.
Yeah, it's interesting to see if they take a mixture of experts' architectural point of view on 5, or if they still think, or if they think they need to double down on the 4.5 direction. So 4.5 basically 10x the number of parameters. Every 0.5 is 10x the number of parameters. I don't know if they will 10x from 4.5 to 5. It'll be interesting to see where they go. But listen, everything you highlight, like you're talking about here in terms of the number of models, I think underscores the point of how early we are, right? Like, this is not a usable user interface. It's only still a few number of people who feel like they have discovered what is, you know, an infinitely deep goldmine, and we keep spreading it to everybody. It's still early days, and how these user, like, is a text, you know, chat window really even the right user interface, or does it all just fold into some AR kind of mode? I think we're still in very early days, and there's a lot more juice to squeeze from this lemon in the application layer. So I'm very curious to see the applications that come out, even with the existing models, which are very good, right? Like O3 can probably solve, you know, I think Sam Mormon said some pretty crazy stat, like 10% of the world's productivity can be absorbed by AI, right? So I think that should be the singular vision to realize, right? Like, actually squeeze this juice, actually fix that application layer, make it easier for developers to build against these models, make it cheaper, right? Like, this is another very, very under talked about thing, is how efficient these models are. And this is something actually the Google suite of Gemini products excel at. So you look at, you know, like even the Flash models that they have right now in Gemini, they are very, very efficient. So the sort of dollar value that you're getting on the output is pretty fantastic. So that's another whole vector that I think we should think about scaling these models on.
Yeah, for sure. And speaking of the Gemini models, and we were talking about context windows earlier, I believe Gemini 2.5 Pro, the latest one, has 1 million token context windows. So it is interesting how they were able to raise the bar so much higher than, and O3 has something like 200,000. One last point on O3. Folks who are listening should try the GeoGuessr game, which is you show it a random photo from anywhere in the world, right? And it can figure out based on the texture of the vegetation or whatever it is, it can narrow down the location very quickly, uncanny, and it shows its entire chain of thought. It's really good at things like that, which is sort of was a bit of a mind-blowing moment for me to see its thought process in geoguessing, and then just philosophical and mathematical reasoning as well. There's an otherworldly, a seemingly otherworldly element to how it approaches those. And I'm sure you've experienced that with your coding and the tasks that you've used as well.
Yeah, I focus a lot on coding as my main. And then there's all the music stuff I was telling you about too, but music and coding are the two areas I've been kind of very, very over-indexed on. The one thing I'll say about the context window is, you know, a large context window, more isn't always more. You do have to weigh it against how good its recall is within that context window. And to be fair, I do think 2.5 Pro has a pretty good or near perfect recall, this needle in a haystack test in that context window. All of this to say, is it able to recall information well within that context window? Being able to scale these windows, but while also improving the kind of unit economics on them, and this is the key point here, makes it usable. Because, you know, if it's still pretty expensive on a per token basis, it becomes prohibitive for enterprises to, let's say, put their entire knowledge base on it, right? Mm-hmm. Because that is sort of where the rubber hits the road with a lot of these large context windows. So that is still something to be seen. It's not clear if short-term memory even is the right architecture for solving this kind of a problem. I think jury is still out, in my opinion, on RAG versus fine-tuning versus prompt engineering for these kind of solutions. And there may be other architectures that still, you know, can be applied to applying AI to proprietary information, which is really, I think, what you were alluding to, Avi, when you were talking about the context window.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Dr. Neural MD, I know we've gone over the time that we'd agreed upon, but so I do want to thank you for your generosity and for taking the time and for sharing your wisdom. And maybe we'll come back in the next few months to understand more about where your music projects are heading, what things you've done in healthcare, what new innovations, how much waste you've reduced. But yes, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Robbie. It was nice chatting with you.
All right.